back in session.
Please be seated. This is Friedman versus Friedman. Our panel has been reconstituted. Chief Justice Cherry is sitting in for Justice Perigary, who realized he had a conflict this morning. So with that, parties ready to proceed, please do so. We understand that the appellants are splitting their 15 minutes.
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm going to take the first 5 minutes and deal with the summary judgment issue. My colleague, Mr. Jones, is going to take the next 5 minutes and deal with all of the other issues, and then we're going to reserve five for rebuttal, if that's okay. Thank you. Good morning, Justices. Appreciate the time here this morning. Nick Santoro on behalf of David Friedman. In granting summary judgment, the district court found that David Friedman waived all of his rights to the Cushion account. The Cushion account was an account set up for extraordinary expenses of the parties, not monthly expenses. At all times, there were two significant rights afforded to David in all the documents with respect to the Cushion account. One, that his prior approval was required for any expenditure, and there was a procedure that had to be followed to get his approval in advance. And number two, that he always had the right to one half of the money that should have been in that account. Ultimately, without ever having approved a single expenditure, David got nothing because Abby, as it turned out, without his knowledge, had spent all the money from that account. Without permitting any discovery, without taking any evidence, without hearing any testimony, the district court summarily concluded two things. Number one, that David intended to waive all of his rights in the Cushion account by the documents that were signed. Number one, a contract interpretation issue, intent of the parties. Number two, that David knowingly waived all of his rights in that account, the law of waiver. Waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. Respectfully, the judge committed error on both of these counts. There were a series of orders and agreements that pertained to the Cushion accounts. There was the initial order, there was a settlement outline that was done later, and then in the month of March of 2009, we have a stipulation and order, we have a marital settlement agreement, and ultimately a decree of divorce. These documents created the Cushion account and reserved certain specific rights to David in those accounts, and in certain instances, waived certain rights, such as accountings and audits. So the first question, the question of intent, is one purely of contract interpretation. What did these waivers mean? What were the intention of the parties? What was David waiving and what was David not waiving? And what I will tell Your Honors is this. The parties offered competing and conflicting interpretations of what those documents mean. Remember, there was no evidence or testimony taken. They pointed to some language to say that it amounts to a wholesale waiver by David in the Cushion account. And it had to because he ended up getting nothing and the court condoned that. So they point to some language. We pointed to specific reservations in the documents to show that David always and never waived his right to prior approval of any expenditure of the account and that he never waived his right to one half of the money that should have been in that account. And in fact, he never did waive either of those significant rights. Based upon the competing and conflicting interpretations of these documents, and what I would submit to the court is significant ambiguity in those documents when you read them as a whole, what the trial court should have done was delve beyond the four corners of those documents to ascertain the party's true intentions. Under well-established Nevada jurisprudence on contract interpretation, the court should have taken evidence to look at the conduct of the parties, the surrounding circumstances, the credibility of the parties, their intentions. The court should have tried to reconcile conflicting language in the documents, and most importantly, the court was not at liberty to read out certain portions of the documents and ignore certain portions and just focus on other portions, which is what happened. Instead of delving beyond the four corners, the trial court found these documents to be clear and unambiguous and summarily adjudicated the intention of the parties that David had waived all of his rights in this Cushion account. This was error. My time is very limited, and I could walk you through all of the documents now, but we've laid it out in our brief. I could demonstrate how David never waived those rights and that, at a minimum, there's ambiguity, which should have required an evidentiary hearing. Instead, what I'd like to do is focus the rest of my time on the second issue, and that is, if as a matter of law, the district court could have concluded that from the documents alone, without any testimony, that David intended to waive his rights to that entire Cushion account, which I submit was error because they were not clear and unambiguous, Abby still had to show that David's waiver was a knowing waiver, that in fact he knew that she had violated the court order by not getting his prior approval for these expenditures and that she had spent the money at the time she extracted the waiver. She had to show that. The waiver must be meaningful and knowing. A waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. Under Nevada law, a valid waiver requires knowledge by the waiving party of the material facts relevant to the waiver. The idea is you can't waive what you do not know. Here, Abby was under a duty, literally from the start, to obtain his prior express approval. There was a procedure set up in the order. She had to send him an email, and he had to send her back one, saying it's okay. That never happened. There's no email in this record where she ever sought his approval. Yet ultimately, she spent all the money. David had a right to rely on that order that protected him, that said she had to get his approval. When she did not get his approval, he had the right to rely on that order and believe that all the money was still in the account. Well, in fact, all the money had been spent in violation of the order.
Weren't there some reimbursements Mrs. Friedman gave to Mr. Friedman about the cushion account? Maybe it was improper expenditures, but it kind of washed out at the end?
No, Your Honor, for this reason. There was a check for $18,000 that he got. Mm-hmm. The issue from that is she said, well, you must have known. And that's really what we're down to. You must have known, you should have known, you had to know. Not I followed the procedure and got your approval, and you signed off on it. You constructively, you should have known. He was entitled to that reimbursement from the other account. He didn't know which account it came from. He had the right to get the money. Whether or not he knew it was from the cushion account as opposed to this account, that's a factual question. This is the problem here. He couldn't have knowingly waived unless they prove that he knew that she had violated the order already. That's why they spent so much time in their brief on what he could have known or should have known or might have known. The waiver is simply not valid unless they show he knew. How do they do that? In their brief at page 21 and in several other places, and I'm quoting from 21, quote, what can be inferred by the waiver of any right to object to expenditures is that David knew there were expenditures he did not approve. So what they're trying to do is to fill the evidentiary gap of what David knew or should have known with inferences of what he knew or should have known. And they do it repeatedly. The problems with this, justices, are obvious. Number one, what he knew or should have known are disputed questions of fact that should have been resolved by the taking of evidence. That's the Millspex case, this court. Number two, and this is very important, as a matter of law, all of the inferences to be drawn on a summary judgment should have been drawn in David's favor as the party opposing resisting summary judgment. In fact, what they're asking this court to do and what the district court erroneously did was to draw inferences in favor of Abby that he knew or should have known.
Counsel, you're under 8 minutes at this point.
Okay. And with that, I would submit that it was error on both counts, and I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Justices. As to the issue of attorney's fees, which is one of the largest issues, because it was a very carefully negotiated attorney's fees provision, which dealt with the enforcement of the agreement being the triggering effect for attorney's fees if either party had to enforce the agreement. Now, in the briefs, Abby's counsel tries to point to contempt as the only issue that actually really matters, when in reality the specific provision for attorney's fees deals with enforcement. In fact, it doesn't just say attorney's fees in the agreement. It says enforcement of agreement as an entirely separate paragraph. Now, initially on the attorney's fees issue, the flaw at the district court level of awarding Abby any fees deals with the fact that their supporting brief does not contain an affidavit pursuant to Miller versus Wilfong. They talk about saying other evidence, but mere attachment of your invoices is not evidence of issues such as establishment of the quality of the character of the advocate, the character of the work, or the result. That can only be obtained by submitting an affidavit under Miller versus Wilfong, which was not done on either the brief or the reply brief. Now, as it pertains to the specific line items of things that David sought relief for by enforcing the agreement, he was in a position where he sought enforcement of many issues that were then begrudgingly complied with after the filing of the motion, before the final adjudication on the merits. So when we have a look at the actual agreement and the language, it says whether prosecuted to judgment or not. So those items that were either summarily granted by the court at the initial hearing, summarily granted by the court at the hearing on the second motion for order to show cause and compel compliance, or things that actually Abby satisfied only after the filing of the motion were items that specifically, while not gone to trial, did not proceed to judgment, were items that David prevailed upon, and that's how we get to the actual Homewood analysis, where we believe that on the record, with the decision as it pertains to the opening of the line of credit, David is the prevailing party under the Homewood analysis, as it proves that he won one significant issue.
Now, the attorney's fees, we have the $2,500 that was awarded to Mrs. Friedman, and we have the $150 to Mrs. Friedman, the $50 to Mr. Friedman. Okay, so is that...
I'm focusing, Your Honor, on the issue of the $150. The $2,500 was awarded as a result of the motion for summary judgment. We believe that the remedying of the summary judgment will then obviously remedy the attorney's fees. But as it pertains to the actual analysis applied by the court, A, the findings were insufficient to support the award of attorney's fees, but B, there were so many other issues on which David was the prevailing party. And it's actually in our responsive brief that, you know, we listed all the different items that he was prevailing party on, yet those were not part of what the court found as the basis. The court below ignored the Homewood analysis, and the chart establishes all the manners in which David was the prevailing party and should have been the only person under which fees were awarded.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing with Denise Gentile on behalf of the respondent, and I'm going to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal on the cross appeal. This is a case about a husband's efforts to dominate his wife after their divorce. David refuses to accept a world in which Abby Friedman is not under his thumb. This record reflects that Abby is the victim of what I would characterize as post-divorce litigation bullying. And David has enough money that he can continue filing motions, frivolous motions, and harass Abby Friedman basically forever. In the summary judgment motion, the fundamental rule of contract interpretation is that if a contract is clear and unambiguous, it doesn't need to be interpreted, it should just be applied. And that's exactly what we have here. The waiver provisions were at the end of a divorce that involved a huge marital estate. There were a lot of very complicated, very important issues. When it got down to the end, the only thing left was the cushion account. And the amount of money at most in that account was significantly less than 1% of the overall divorce. So the parties decided, let's not hang up this whole thing. Let's get it over with. And the way they did that was that David waived his right to an accounting, waived his right to question any expenditures from that account, and that was their way of getting it over with. The contract provisions were clear and unambiguous. And there were really three different sources of the waiver. First was the settlement outline, which said that David acknowledges and agrees that as part of the party's settlement, as set forth in this settlement outline, David waives any right he may have to seek an independent audit of the cushion accounts and or to seek any reimbursement from Abby for any expenditures paid through the cushion accounts. Then they had the settlement agreement, which contained broad mutual waivers of all claims by either side. Then they had the March 23, 2009 stipulation, which was 3 days before the divorce decree. And the stipulation said both parties mutually waive any objections to community expenditures by either party through the date of this stipulation.
Mr. Eisenberg, how do you respond to the position asserted as to it not being a knowing waiver?
Well, first of all, when David's counsel opposed summary judgment, there was no affidavit from David. And when you're going to oppose summary judgment, if you want to raise a genuine issue of material fact, you have to do it in an affidavit, and there was none. The knowing waiver, what the judge found, and there was no dispute, that at the time of the divorce, there was a lengthy canvassing of the parties, and they both agreed to it. And what he claims he didn't know was what was in the account. And I would characterize this as saying that David knew what he didn't know. He didn't know how much was in the account, and he knew that fact. And he waived his right to an accounting. He waived his right to make any claim regarding the expenditures out of that account. By analogy, if a husband and wife had a complex divorce, they negotiated everything, and at the very end, all that was left was a locked hope chest. And they both had keys to the lock, but the husband didn't bother to use his key and look to see what was in it. And in order to get the whole thing resolved, the husband decides, I just waive my right to find out what's in it. And then after the divorce, he finds out, and the wife gets it, and after the divorce, he finds out there was some valuable property in it. Well, if he came to court and said, the waiver's no good because I didn't know what was in the hope chest, he'd be laughed out of court because what he waived was his right to find out what was in the hope chest. Well, it's the same thing here. He knew, or he claims that he didn't know what was in the account, and he knew that fact, and he waived it. Additionally, the evidence shows, undisputed evidence, that he had access to the account. All he had to do was sit down at his computer and click on the buttons, and he could find out exactly what was in it. And the evidence showed that one of his employees did, in fact, access the account. So for him to claim that he didn't know it was in the account and therefore it wasn't a knowing waiver, it just doesn't connect, Your Honor. He waived any objection to the expenditures from the account, and he was entitled to get half of what was left, but as it turns out, there wasn't anything left in the account. He knew that he had gotten a check for $18,000 out of that account, and it originally had $250,000, and then that money was gone. They had to replenish it with another $50,000. So he's claiming here he's entitled to half of $50,000. Well, he already knew that $18,000 was spent out of that account, and in fact, they did account for all of the expenditures, and as it turns out, there wasn't any money left. So that's what we're talking about on this issue. Additionally, Your Honor, I would point out that I would suggest to the court that public policy favors such a waiver as in this case. When parties have a very complex divorce with a large marital estate, and they've resolved everything except one relatively minor issue, and they decide to waive their rights regarding that issue so they can get the whole thing resolved and not have to go to trial on it. The public policy of the courts should be to encourage that kind of waiver and to enforce it where it's clear and unambiguous, as it is in this case.
What about the attorney's fees calculations?
Regarding the attorney's fees, counsel says they were the prevailing party and they won on one significant issue. The fact is, they didn't win on any significant issue. They won on one finding of fact regarding the home equity line of credit. But the judge denied relief on that because in order to get contempt, you have to show not only was there a breach, but that it was an intentional or willful.
But Mrs. Friedman, she paid off the home equity line, didn't she?
Right. Well, what happened was that the equity credit line was originally in effect for both of them, a joint credit line. In the summer of 2008, it had been frozen because of the divorce. She asked Dean Witter and Morgan Stanley to reinstate it, and then about 6 months later, the divorce occurs, and it's reinstated and still got David's name on it. Mm-hmm. And she forgot. And the district judge found that she should have remembered that 6 months earlier it had David's name on it. She should have told the bank back then to take his name off. That's it. And then there was an email from David's counsel to Abby's counsel telling them about the fact after David found out Then the very next day, there's some emails between Abby and her lawyer where they're talking about it, and they're going to find out what's happening. And the next day after that, David files a motion for contempt. So 2 days after his email notifying them, they took care of it. It was either the evidence or the record is unclear whether it was a zero balance or $57 was the balance of it, with no harm to David, no lien on his house, no nothing taken care of. Which reminds me of another point. Counsel has suggested here that it was that these various things were only complied with by Abby after the motion was filed. And he suggests that Abby complied with the provisions of the settlement agreement because of the motion. There's no evidence of that. They've argued that all along. There's no evidence. The district judge made no finding in that regard. And he filed his motion before the April 30th, 2009 deadline. So when she complied with it, she would have complied anyway. There's no evidence to suggest that the motion caused her to comply. With regard to the prevailing party issue, he suggests that he did win on a significant issue. Well, to be a prevailing party under the Hornwood case, you have to prevail on a significant issue in the case, and you have to have achieved some benefit. The judge found that on the home equity line of credit issue, although there was a technical breach by Abby because she didn't remember that 6 months earlier when she reinstated the account, David's name was on it. Technical breach, but it wasn't an intentional or willful breach. And in addition, the record shows no harm whatsoever to David. So at the very end on that issue, the judge found, it is further ordered that the order to show cause against Abby Friedman is denied with respect to reinstatement of the party's joint home equity line of credit with Morgan Stanley. So she denied relief. And that would be what they're claiming as well. Because the judge made that one finding in their favor, that it was a technical breach, that they prevailed. Well, that's not prevailing. You have to prevail on the claim, not simply one claim. It would be like in a personal injury case. If a plaintiff had a cause of action with alleging negligence, causation, and damages, and the judge found that there was negligence but no causation or damage, the plaintiff loses. The plaintiff is not the prevailing party, and that's what we had here. He had to prove a breach, willful and intentional, and some damages. He convinced the judge there was a breach, but not the other two, so the judge denied relief. And in the order on attorney's fees, the judge noted that David did not prevail on any single one of his claims. The judge also exercised her discretion by concluding that the attorney's fee award was justified by NRS 18.010. She found that four of his claims were frivolous. She didn't use the word frivolous, but she said that there were no reasonable grounds for them, and that those claims were prosecuted to create unnecessary litigation for Abby. And those findings were absolutely justified. On the cross appeal we have, the judge awarded $50,000 on the home equity line of credit issue against Abby in favor of David when the issue really was nothing. A couple of emails that could have been exchanged to resolve the whole thing. $50,000 was one-third of the attorney's fees that David was seeking. He was asking for $150,000. The judge gave him a third of that for the home equity line of credit issue. He was claiming that his attorney spent 380 hours litigating this post-divorce stuff. A third of that is about 125 hours that this judge awarded for attorney's fees for the home equity line of credit issue, which on this record could have been resolved in probably 1 hour of attorney's time, maybe 2 hours at the most. So we believe that the judge had ample evidence to support her findings and did not abuse her discretion on the other issues, but on the award of attorney's fees to David, the $50,000, that was a manifest abuse of discretion and should be reversed. I'd like to, unless the court has some questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal on the cross appeal.
All Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. As it pertains to the history of this case that's contained in the rather large appendix, the motivation of David Friedman in this case has always been to obtain compliance with the agreements the parties reached. The court will recall that the parties settled their case in November of 2008 by a settlement agreement that was mediated for many, many, many weeks. Then, when we couldn't get any traction as it pertains to the marital settlement agreement decree of divorce, a motion was required to be filed by David to try to enforce the settlement. The only thing that accomplished was to finally get Abby to respond and move towards a resolution of the case, or to have a trial date set at that point. So this whole concept that David is trying to abuse Abby is just a misstatement of the history of this case. All he's wanted was the benefit of his bargain. That's all he's ever sought. This concept that they had a large marital estate and therefore these issues are really small is really a red herring, simply because all he knew that he was tied via their agreement to Abby for many, many, many years post-divorce. They had many obligations they needed to meet, many of which were the subject of the motions to compel compliance because they weren't being met. Expenses weren't being reimbursed. And when the court considers the actual line items of things that David was the prevailing party on, that's why it's not just the one line of credit issue under Hornwood. It's all of the things that were granted summarily at the hearings, because that's the important thing that gets ignored, is at the initial hearing, the evidentiary hearing on the order to show cause was not just set on the issue of contempt, it was set on the issue of attorney's fees. The transcript of the hearing at the initial hearing will reveal that this was a big issue because so much effort had taken place to get to that initial hearing, to get the things that Abby begrudgingly paid and satisfied her obligations to, that the attorney's fees at that point were already significant just to try to get compliance with that. So when it comes down to the issue of the waiver, and while my colleague addressed those initially, in response, it can't be ignored that they rely almost primarily on the stipulation of March 23rd. Well, the decree of divorce was entered after the stipulation of March 23rd. The decree of divorce merges the marital settlement agreement and merges the settlement outline. It doesn't merge the stipulation. So the final order in this case requires all of the things that they are claiming were waived. But more importantly, the language of the stipulation doesn't say David waives his right to one half of the contents of the account. It doesn't, because he was never waiving one half of the contents of the account. He may have been waiving her requirement to produce SCAD's documents and have a review of all of those and try to justify expenditures, but the thing that gets missed by the argument of Ms. Friedman is that, in fact, David did know to some degree, or should have known, that there was money in that account that he wouldn't waive, because until she got his approval, she couldn't spend a dime. So this idea that he had access to go to the bank account, to get online, these things that I'm not sure are part of the record, but even we'll leave it to just an argument. The one thing he did know and could rely upon, based upon the rights guaranteed to him in the decree and in the settlement outline and marital settlement agreement, was that until such time as Ms. Friedman asked his permission to spend a nickel from the cushion account, he knew the money that was put in there last had to necessarily still be there. That's where the argument fails. Now, when it comes down to the issue of affidavits, there are multiple affidavits. There's an affidavit of me supporting the issue. There's affidavits of David throughout this process. They all address this issue of that would satisfy the issue of material fact. But more importantly, it was not David's burden. There was no evidence to support, as my colleague stated, the inference in favor of the moving party under summary judgment. So from that standpoint, and while there was some other issues that obviously their time is limited, and I know that you've read the pleadings and briefs, but from the standpoint of the summary judgment issues and the record as it pertains to attorney's fees, the record that we've actually established that carries the day as it pertains to those issues do not support the findings and orders that were entered by the district court below. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank Your Honor. On the cross appeal involving the award of attorney's fees, counsel argues that David was a prevailing party. If you read anything else in this lengthy appendix, I ask you to read pages 24 and 25 of the district court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. It's at appendix pages 29, 64, and 65. And in that order, the judge goes through the entire list of every single one of David's claims, findings number 189 through 195, and every single one is denied, including the claim regarding the home equity line of credit. It was denied. He was not the prevailing party on any claim involving the case, and he did not obtain any benefit, which is what the case law requires in order to be a prevailing party. And my final comment just has to do with the whole merger issue. When that divorce decree was entered, it incorporated the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement incorporated the settlement outline. The settlement outline was revised by the March 23, 2009 stipulation, which was signed by the parties and ordered by the court 3 days before the divorce decree. So that stipulation, despite counsel's best efforts to tear it up and throw it away, was valid and was incorporated within the divorce decree. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank counsel for the arguments this morning. As to this matter, it will stand submitted at this time. We'll take a real curt recess to reconstitute for our two remaining matters. Thank you.